Support for Technology and Innovation Reporting comes from SDN Communications, your business broadband provider. Learn more at sdncommunications.com. Welcome to Innovation. I'm Kara Hetland, and joining me now, we are going to talk with Dr. Kevin Ward. He's an assistant professor of geology and geological engineering at South Dakota School of Mines and Technology. Kevin Ward, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation, and I appreciate the opportunity.
So we're talking about earthquakes and being able to monitor these earthquakes from right here in a bunker in Rapid City, correct? So paint me a picture of what you inherited when you first arrived at School of Mines a year or so ago.
Right. So this was a little bit of a surprise to me. I didn't know we had such a facility, such a structure on campus. But it just turns out one of the professors here knew about it and had some interest in seismology, knew I was a new faculty member here and interested in seismology. And so after talking with him for a little bit, he arranged to give me a little tour of this little facility, the bunker, as we call it. And so in principle, I've seen these kind of structures or facilities elsewhere throughout the United States. One that was different about this one was no longer currently used to actively monitor earthquakes or seismic motion of any kind. So what I thought was interesting, I got in there, I saw this space, it wasn't really being used, but it was definitely built for this purpose, and I tried to think of a way that I could take advantage of that space, at least in the beginning, to try and start off with one of these little tiny seismometers that I put in there just to see what we could see.
So let's just step back a little bit. The history of this is that this bunker was built into the side of a hill in 1960 and was part of the USGS Global Seismograph Network, but as Rapid City grew and the vibrations could be picked up, but this was equipment, you know, that was so large and that took up about three rooms, right? And it picked up all of the vibrations and noise as trains go by, cars go by, and that kind of thing. So it was no longer of use, and it was abandoned in the 1990s. So that's a little history there. So you have this room built in, but the seismograph is a lot smaller than it was in 1960, right?
Right. So at the time, the instruments that were there and are still there were state-of-the-art. But that was well before the digital age where we have computers and everything was analog and mechanical. So it just physically took up a lot of space. The one that I installed recently, you're correct, it's much smaller, and it's primarily because of that, because of the advances in technology, specifically electronics, really eliminates a lot of those large, heavy mechanical pieces that were required back in the day. But now you can get away with something that does basically the same thing in a much, much smaller package.
So it's the size of your hand?
About, yeah. It's a couple inches tall, and that's just because it's in a case. It's maybe 6 inches by 4 inches. Really, all you need is just a little size ammometer, and that is actually the size of, even smaller. That's an inch by an inch by an inch. And so really, it could be much smaller just for cost savings and to make it a appealing package. Really, it's the size that it is. But once you have that little tiny seismometer and a couple of very small computer pieces, that's all it really takes to do the same thing nowadays.
Wow. And so explain now for us how it all works.
So the nice thing about this and what sort of caught my interest initially about just trying this system out is you have a small little, like I said, seismometer in there that basically measures the motion, in this case, just vertical or up and down motion. When it does that, it generates a little electronic current that is measured by another tiny little computer inside there. And then that just basically converts that to a signal that can be read by computers. And the nice thing about this particular setup is in addition to being able to connect it to a landline, you can also broadcast that over a Wi-Fi signal. And so that really helps with a lot of the problems because when this facility was originally built, there was no internet. That kind of infrastructure wasn't there. So I thought having this little tiny device that could broadcast this over the local Wi-Fi would be a really good way to not only make use of this building, but also take advantage of the newer technology.
And when you say broadcast over Wi-Fi, that means send you regular alerts or that kind of thing. Or is it for others to monitor too?
Right. So with this, the nice thing about this little package I bought is someone has already spent all the time doing the hard work, not only putting up the physical equipment, but they've also designed some software and a nice network, a web interface, where basically when I say broadcast, that data, that seismogram, goes into this national, really global repository. So at any time later on, we can go back and look at it, or anyone else that wants to look at it in real time can access not only that site, but also all of the other about 800 or so of these type instruments that are currently operating throughout the world today.
So describe what you see for data.
So every place is a little different, and I can clearly see, at least as far as why the research grade seismometers that were there originally were moved elsewhere. What really interests me and what I try and show with my students is there's still a lot of interesting things that you can pick up as far as the data. And so one of the first and obvious ones is you can see that when you look at the data at night versus during the daytime, it's a lot quieter. There's a lot less noise. So you can really pick up all this, the general background waves of people being there. What's really interesting and probably the largest signal is the train. The train produces a huge signal. We're somewhat close to the railroad tracks and with no regularity, but a couple times a day we may see a train go through downtown, and you could pick that up without any trouble on the seismogram. What I didn't expect and what I thought was kind of interesting was the bunker is sort of located near a road that is well-traveled, and so there just happens to be some irregularities on the road that, depending on which way the car is going, you can actually see that in the seismogram data, and you can infer or figure out which way, whether the car was going uphill or downhill.
What if they fix the road? No.
Well, I guess we lose that ability. We just have to look at earthquakes from other parts of the world.
And when you say that you've seen earthquakes picked up on there from other parts of the world, about what kind of time delay is there from when it actually occurs to when you're actually able to measure it?
So it's usually pretty quick. It somewhat depends on where on the other side of the globe we're picking it up. But usually it's within less than 10 minutes, certainly, depending on the locations. The few that I've seen so far that I've looked at, you can very clearly see the arrival. Even though there's all this train noise and car traffic, there's ways we can, through processing, filter out all that and actually look at the earthquakes. And so within about 10 minutes or so, we can see some of these events.
And obviously the needle moves a little more than a train would make it move, or no?
Well, actually, cars? It's the other way around, the train,
really?
Because they're so close. As far as there's no needles anymore, per se, in these type of instruments, but they do generate more vertical motion or up and down motion just because they're so close. The difference is, and the reason we can tell those from the earthquakes, which actually, as you might imagine, because they're so far away, sometimes on the other side of the world, they actually produce much less ground motion, but the ground motion they produce is much longer wavelength, or it has a longer period. So we can look at these waveforms, take them into the frequency domain, and just look at how much frequency content it is, and that's really the best identifier. Even though the ground is moving less with these earthquakes versus, say, the cars going by or the trains, we can use that information to directly identify some of these larger earthquakes elsewhere in the world.
And as you look at the waveforms of an earthquake, has it changed over time? About them changed over time, I guess?
Each individual earthquake will look a little different, and it'll look a little different not only depending on the actual event or earthquake, but also depending on where it's recorded. Because the key thing to think about with an earthquake is it generates some energy, and that energy has to travel all the way through the earth to wherever it's being recorded. And so as far as previous earthquakes in the past, they don't really look different other than the sense that they travel through different things. And that's where more of my interest is because as we see how these waveforms travel and through the earth and change, we can actually learn a lot about what those waves are going through. And that is the basis of my current research.
Well, that's where I was headed. So why don't you talk a little bit more about your current research and what it is you're doing?
Yeah, so my current research, really, there's a lot of broad definitions on how you define seismologists and how you can break them up. Some people study exactly just the earthquakes, how they are generated, why they're generated, and I tend to be on the other side. Those seismologists are called source side. I tend to be a structural side. And so as I was alluding to, because those energy, those waves that travel to the earth have to go through different parts of it, I can use that information, how they travel. If I have a lot of seismometers in a certain area, I can look for differences in how that energy may arrive, whether it's a line or a grid of seismometers. And basically, depending on what I'm interested in, I could learn something about the very, very shallow crust. We're talking a couple hundred meters. Or I can see all the way down into the lower crust and uppermost mantle at hundreds of kilometers depth.
And so are you placing seismometers other places? Or?
Right. So there's a large network of permanent stations that exist. My research now is focusing more on temporary deployments. And what we mean from that is that we put out some of these seismometers, maybe 100, 200, for anywhere from 40 days to a couple years. And the reason we do that is because we can put a large number of these seismometers in a very specific area, an area that we might be more interested in seeing what's underneath. And so recently I've done some of that in the Andes, but even more recently since I've got here, I've been focusing more on Alaska with these large temporary deployments.
And so these are being placed right now currently or are being monitored currently in Alaska, is that right?
Right. So there's a large program that has been going on for over a decade now that has put some of these older style, very large seismometers in Alaska, and their spacing is about 100 kilometers apart. So they're not very dense. But more recently, what I've been more involved with, and those are currently right now in the ground, is back in February we put about 400 of these smaller type instruments in the ground that are a little bit easier to deploy, and they're less expensive, so you can actually have physically more of them. And our goal there is, within, I guess, 40 days at the end of this month, we'll be going back to Alaska to pick them up. And the little difference is that, with the example I said before, that sends out the data over wireless. You can just automatically get it. These only record onboard, so we have to go back, pick them up, and we really won't know what we see until we go back there, collect them all, download the data.
So there really isn't Wi-Fi there on the mountains in Alaska?
Well, I tell you, the cell phone service is not good. And there is some, surprisingly, considering we're out in the middle of nowhere. The biggest thing is it turns out to be that not only infrastructure-wise, the ability to transmit that actually takes up a lot of space and also battery power. So you have to build these larger and larger instruments. They become heavier. That means they become more expensive. So you can do it. You can have this data available in real time. It just limits how many you can have and then the places that you can actually deploy these. So we make the sacrifice having to wait a few weeks to get the data in order to get presumably better coverage and more data.
And so these are when you say they're small, they're still, the size of a gym bag maybe?
So even smaller than that. So okay. The one that we've been talking about that I installed here on campus, that's more of it would be considered an amateur type. These are the kind that people who just have an interest in seismology might buy and put on their desk. These larger ones that we deployed are still only about the size of a small paint can. They only weigh 6 or 7 pounds. But that's just because they have a few more pieces and they last a little longer and record a little bit better data. But they still are research grade and we can do cutting edge science with them.
And when you get this data back, what do you hope to learn? What's your hypothesis?
Excellent. So this one is kind of a unique experiment that there's a large amount of groups, so there's a lot of different people working on it. All of them have different interests. My interest specifically is related to the geometry of what we did in the array. And so what I mean by that is we put them along a highway, a road, 306 of them every kilometer. So what that ends up being for us is we have a very long line of seismometers with very dense coverage. And the reason we chose that location is because there's a subduction zone there in Alaska. And so that just means the oceanic plate in the Pacific is subducting or going underneath Alaska there. And just like in Cascadia, Japan, all these places where there are some of the largest earthquakes that we see anywhere in the world, they occur in subduction zones. So So our goal, our hypothesis, what we're trying to see, and what these new instruments and this deployment will hopefully reveal, is we're trying to look for tiny differences in how those two plates connect, or what their interface looks like. Because that, as that plate subducts, that's where all that energy is stored. And then when a large earthquake happens, that's where it's released. So getting a better understanding or an idea of what that interface looks like, we hope will help us have a better idea of potentially what type of earthquakes we're looking at, future potential hazard modeling, and also what the structure of that interface looks like might be used as an analog in other places, such as Oregon, Cascadia, Washington, with the same goals in mind, trying to understand the system better to limit or understand, mitigate the hazard associated with these large earthquakes.
So there's constant movement in the Earth that you can measure?
Yeah, so the Earth is a very dynamic place, and I tend to talk a lot about earthquakes, and those are really just things that capture our attention. But in reality, in the last decade or so, the Earth has constantly been moving, and we've been exploring that more and more. And so earthquakes you can use to do a lot of the same things as far as imaging I've talked about. But the Earth is always moving, and so in previous years, it used to be too expensive to just constantly record data because we didn't have computers and it was mechanically expensive. Now we can constantly record the data. And it turns out when you look at all that information, even when there isn't a large earthquake, there's still a lot of seismic data about the Earth structure that you can look at. So the Earth is always moving, whether you feel it or not.
And we're just now able to measure it.
We're able to measure it. Part of it is, as I said before, it's now technologically reasonable that we can record it constantly. But also, we're just now starting to realize that there's all this information that's basically in the background. We call it ambient noise. And so typically in the past, we would try and filter that out. So part of it is that we now have the instruments and it's economically possible to record all this, but also seismologists have been establishing all the mathematical tools to actually use that information.
And is this data that is just freely shared with other scientists?
It is. That's part of what the seismological community has been fairly good at. In general, you can go online and get a lot of this, for example, the Global Seismic Network data. The difference is for these temporary deployments, there's a little bit of logistics involved as far as us getting the data back, processing it, making sure it's it has good quality. But even that has to be made publicly available within a year or two. So depending on the project or the instruments used, all this data is either available right away, immediately, in real time, or within a couple years.
Kevin Ward, I want to thank you very much for taking time and coming on the program today. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to having you back when you have some results.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity again.